Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
I'm a shot in the dark, very short of spark.
Welcome back to The Whaley Show. I am your humble host, aforementioned Whaley, Andrew. And you're listening to Breadbox Media. All right, kids, here we go, episode 6. First of all, mea culpa on not doing a show last week. Shout out to John McClain for bemoaning my lack of a show in social media public. I'm sorry, John. I offered that he could come down and take me to coffee, and I tell him what I thought. You know, the truth be told, last week I sat down to do a show. I had just lived a very, very practical, very non-reflective week, and I did the first 15 minutes of the show, and it was just me bitching about politics and talking about what was going. I just didn't feel it. It wasn't flowing. It wasn't good. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to take the week off. I'm just not doing it. Just like this. I don't feel like, yeah, I mean, this is a pretty off the cuff episode today. I don't mind doing something that's kind of a little nonlinear, obviously, and that can kind of go where it's going to go. But I like to at least have it be a real, a real insight into, or a real kind of like a reflection of, you know, reality in some way. And if that's not the case, then I just don't really feel like saying anything, you know? So it's funny, when I was doing the Daily Show, back in the day, probably the four times a week average show, I just kind of stayed in that moment where I was constantly kind of looking at the principles and the ideas and the patterns underneath things all the time, trying to come up with stuff that was kind of for the show, taking little notes in my phone and stuff. And I just, you know, with the weekly show, I've kind of gotten out of that. And I do see now, I mean, I've got a lot of possible interviews that I'm chatting with people about, and I want to start doing some interviews. I just wanted to get like the first 10 shows or so, get back in the saddle and just do what I do, just me talking, you know, and then start bringing some other people into that. So I'm hoping that some of the formats of the show will be me talking for a little bit, just kind of catching up, a little riff here and there. Then we'll go to an interview, you know. But so I should get an interview or two in the can and keep them around, because I can always come up with something worth listening to for an intro. Anyway, but I appreciate y'all listening. If I jacked up your rhythm last week by not putting a show out, I apologize. So you could find the show at breadboxmedia.com, the Breadbox Media Podbean page. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your quality podcasts. I think we're on Google Play. I know we're on iHeartMedia for sure. Wherever else we are, I'm not sure. I should find that out. iTunes is where most of you are getting this. So please review us on iTunes. I keep being told that we need to have more reviews on iTunes. And yeah, like us on Facebook, The Whaley Show. And I usually put the episodes out there, maybe link some of the articles that I talk about or something. Or occasionally I just throw rando stuff out there. So, man, I'll tell you what, whatever genetics that I had from being good Southern Missouri stock for several generations, to whatever genetics or DNA that I had that allowed me to handle humidity, I've lost them. You know, 17 years, mostly in California and Colorado, I have lost those. And I thought I was kind of acclimating, which I guess I am kind of acclimating because I'm handling it. But my gosh, this has been brutal this last week. I mean, upper 90s to 100 with like near 100% humidity. At least last week there were like storms every afternoon. It would kind of cool off. But this week has just been, the last 4 or 5 days have just been oppressive, oppressive heat. And just humidity. Is this making me even more homesick for both Colorado and California? Give me a second here. See if you can. This is a different one here. See, that wasn't even a slurp because I'm drinking out of a bottle. What am I drinking? That's my new favorite thing. This is like my, not my new favorite thing. It's an old favorite thing. Especially whenever it's like super hot outside. Spring cherry tea. It's the only Republic of Tea tea that I still like. I mean, I've gone on to like nicer teas and interesting teas, and I usually buy in bulk and make my own teas. But there's something about the stupid cherry essence and blossoms with the green tea, and you cold brew it. I just put like, you know, 10, 11, 12 of those tea bags in a big jar, fill it with filtered water, leave it in the refrigerator overnight, pull them out in the morning. Little bit of stevia. I mean, it is the high humidity, hot weather drink of the summer, man. Ice cold green tea with cherry essence and blossoms. A little bit of stevia. It's good stuff. I'm in. I have coffee already. I'm trying to dial the coffee back just a little bit. I know, shocking. I am the coffee boy, but trying to dial it back a little bit. Speaking of... So I was talking about being homesick, right? I went to Aldi last week and I bought a bag of lemons, you know, and I'm just like buying my stuff at Aldi and there's a bag of lemons and I bought the lemons and I'm in just kind of kicking it in line, putting the stuff on the belt. And I see the name Limonera and I'm like, no, come on. It can't be. I look, sure enough, Limonera Corporation, Santa Paula, California, my old stomping grounds, man. I was literally in Missouri, bought lemons that I used to drive past the trees every day. It's just, I'm just like, oh, come on. Why am I not there? Why am I not next to you trees in California where it's not humid? Mom is killing it. The mom report. I'm going to start doing the mom report. The mom report this week is mom is killing it. I mean, she is doing so good. She is just taking hills, man. Literally and figuratively. She doesn't have to wake me up in the night anymore, which was kind of huge. You know, certain things have to happen in the middle of the night. She needed help with those things. And we have figured out a system, got her strong in the right ways, got the right equipment in the right ways and everything. And I can sleep all night. Yes. Praise God. But she walked for the first time. I haven't got to see this yet. I only heard about it from the therapist. She walked between the bars back and forth 3 times, the full length of it, and just had to steady herself a few times. I've seen her rocking the cane. We have now graduated for the most part to when we leave the house, sometimes we don't even take the wheelchair with us. She can use the, we still have a ramp in the front of the house, but she can get down the ramp, with the walker and into the car, even through the yard into the car, with the walker. And when we get someplace, she can handle walking all the way into church or all the way into the restaurant on her walker now. And the other, the main thing that's great is that she can now, when she's at home, we don't really want her walking around by herself, but she uses the wheelchair around the house if there's no one home, but she can get in and out of the wheelchair, in and out of her recliner, and go into her room, lay her clothes out, do her thing, go get, you know, go to the bathroom, do whatever she needs to do, like by herself when she's alone. Now, which is like made a giant difference. Cause I was down about an hour 15. She will just honestly, she just could not go get up and go to the bath. She couldn't go to the bathroom by herself. And so I had could, the longest we could leave her alone would be like, I don't want her sitting there needing to go to the bathroom. So maybe hour 15 or so. And she wasn't drinking enough cause she was afraid. And I want her to hydrate. So we've got this dialed in and she's doing so good. She's balancing and doing stuff she needs to do. And we're about to take it even farther with some new equipment and stuff. And she's getting, a modicum of independence here. And it's been good. So a lot of my listeners, I know, have been praying for my mom. Keep it up for me. I need it in a big way. So what are we doing with this new, independence? Well, I've got my first trip on the books. I got two trips on the books. So I've got a new client in Minnesota. I'm heading up there at the end of July, going to spend 5 days in beautiful Minneapolis helping someone kind of develop a concept and possibly build a coffee house for their church. And then, and so here's a big announcement. If you're listening, you're listening because you're hearing this. I have booked my first trip back to Denver. So if you're in the Denver contingent of my listeners, I will be in Denver for the wedding of Shiny, the Disney warrior princess, and that big hunk of Texas brisket. Always say that. I'm in so much trouble making fun of him. I am so stoked. I'm so stoked for Antoinette and Blaine. They're going to be such a great couple and it's going to be such a great wedding. And I booked my ticket. It's done. So we handled the kind of the overnights that need to happen and everything and the extra help with mom and we got it dialed. So I am going back to Denver. So the 3rd through the 6th, I will be in Denver, Colorado. There will be events. For starters, if you're around Monday, which I guess is the Feast of Transfiguration, on the 6th, I will be going down to the Augustine Institute for Mass that day at noon and hanging out in the cafe for a few minutes afterwards, but I have a 3:48 flight to catch and I have to return a rental car. So come out, say hi, and there's probably going to be a sushi katsu cheat on my low-carb diet. I did some point while I'm there. I got a couple of cheats planned for the Denver trip. Speaking of the diet, it's going well. It kind of goes in pulses where it's like I'll be just losing crazy. Then it kind of goes backwards a little bit and kind of like slows down. And then all of a sudden it's like boom again, you know. But I'm on track to – I've got a set goal. I got a number that I'm not going to say out loud. That's a big number. It's an important round number that I want to be under when I turn 48 years old on October 2nd. And I'm on track to do it. So, I did have my first big gout episode after. And so it turns out I did some more research. It turns out fasting or rapid weight loss is one of the things that causes elevated uric acid levels and can, in certain people, cause gout. So I had to hydrate more. I had to actually break down and take the medicine. I hate taking that medicine. But I didn't have to kill my diet to get the medicine to work. There's been times in the past that I've been losing weight. I get that gout. I take the medicine and the medicine won't work until I start sabotaging my diet and quit losing weight. I was able to continue losing weight and get rid of the pain. And now I'm pain-free totally and back working out hard and everything. Starting the weightlifting part of my journey here first, I kind of just got familiar with where the equipment is and whatnot at the new gym the other day, but I'm doing a very particular workout that I've done in the past, and it's a really intense, there's different things you do, but there's this once a week, this one workout where you just do these five big exercises all the way to fail in a very slow manner. And it's like, it taxes you. And I kind of like the weekend to recover. So I'm waiting until tomorrow. I guess it's going to be the Friday, maybe even Friday afternoon workout. So, cause I'm not good for much after that workout. So I'm stoked on that. I'm going to really be feeling it on Saturday probably. But yeah, it's feeling good. People are like seeing me and going, hey, you're losing weight, aren't you? I mean, you look good. I'm getting to that point in the game where I don't have to tell people I'm on a diet or that I'm kind of dropping weight. It's like clear to people. So, finally in the chatty first segment, giant, big, fat, huge shout out to Ann Breiling and everybody at Shrine Coffee and the Shrine of St. Joseph in Santa Cruz, California. They completed the first phase of their fundraising. They have a three-part fundraising, and they completed the first phase, and they have got to go ahead, and they are beginning demolition and construction on Shrine Coffee. This is a vision that we've been working on since 1997. This is the thing that Ann and I talked about the night I met her. The first time I was ever in a car just chatting with her, driving down the PCH, the PCH. There's the 101, but there is no one right there. We were driving down the 101, and it's the first time, honestly, it was the first time I'd ever seen the sunset in the Pacific Ocean too. It was that exact same conversation. I gave Ann a ride back from an event in Santa Barbara that we had for the incoming freshmen for Thomas Aquinas College. And we started talking and figured out that we were both in the game of wanting to do coffee houses in college towns to reach people that are hard to reach. And we started talking about, she started telling me about what she wanted to do in Santa Cruz. And that evolved, and we've talked and talked and done, and we've attempted this so many times with different people there. And it is, our hammer swinging. There are actual hammers swinging on this project that we have, that has just been planning and begging and working and strategizing and dreaming and frustration since 1997. It's going to happen. I could not be more stoked. So, massive shout out to Shrine Coffee. If you want to help them get over the next hurdle, go to shrinecoffee.com, click on the give link, and throw some cash at Shrine Coffee. Let's get them over that second hump now. All right, kids. What do we want to talk about this week? I got kind of a bead on something, and I was trying to line it out into an outline, and it really doesn't work out in an outline. I got two things I want to talk about. And the common theme is story and narrative. I've been reading Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller and applying it to Calyx, which is really good. I'm really getting dialed in on what to do with my business and, you know, realizing how to fund it and how to make it happen. And every day getting better and better ideas about it and how to represent those things with the new site that I'm working on. So that'll be launching out really soon. And there's going to be a ton more audio over there for those of you that are, inclined to hear about discipleship and the new evangelization and using hospitality, some of the stuff that I used to talk about on the counter position. There's going to be a ton of audio over on the new website. And 2-3 times a week, new audio coming out on that website. So there will be a podcast and a conversation podcast. Maybe they'll be in the same feed. I haven't decided that yet, but you'll be able to subscribe to those. And then there'll be some actual little things you have to go to the actual site and listen to. Anyway, so I've been listening to Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller, which is, if you own a business or you have a nonprofit or you need to do marketing in any way, shape, or form, go buy Building a Story Brand. I don't know if I have enough listeners to try to cajole Donald Miller onto the podcast, but I would love to do so. If nothing else, I'll maybe try to get him over on the Calyx podcast. You're a Christian. I'm a Christian. You know, we both, you really liked Blue Light Jazz back in the day. So did a million other people. That probably won't work. We'll see what I can do. But so then I just started another book and I'm just barely getting into it, and I'm already like, so it's so funny. So there's this guy, this rando dude, adds me on Facebook. And so here I am on Facebook, or he comments, "Hey, I saw you're an entrepreneur and I'm an entrepreneur. We should be friends." And I'm like, okay, you know, so I add the guy, and we haven't really talked or anything. He just said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, we know a bunch of the same people. You're into the entrepreneurship thing, and you're doing kind of like using social entrepreneurship to do spiritual ends. Cool, great. We should talk sometime, you know." And so then I get this new book, and it turns out this is his book. So the guy's Luke Burgess, and the name of the book is Unrepeatable. And I am telling you what, I don't know who's doing most of the writing on this, Luke or his co-writer, who's a PhD. I don't have the book right in front of me. Yeah, I do. Hold on. It's in my bag. Hold on. I'm getting the book out of the bag. Unrepeatable, Cultivating the Unique Calling of Every Person by Luke Burgess and Joshua Miller, PhD. It's got a foreword by George Weigel, got a blurb by Bishop Robert Barron. These guys aren't messing around. I'm telling you what, whoever's voice is kind of represented in this book, you're like my soulmate. It's like I'm like reading this book and I'm like, exactly. Well, Merton said, and then I turn the page and it's like, well, Thomas Merton said, and I'm like, exactly. Yeah. It's like that guy in the beginning of Introduction to Christianity by Ratzinger, you know, in the opening of Introduction to Christianity, Joseph Ratzinger. I'm like, this guy's like my soulmate. I mean, I get on a riff when I'm reading a book sometimes where I'm like, I see an idea and it reminds me of something. And I think, oh, here's where I would go with this. And they go to the same place every time. I'm like, yes. So I cannot possibly recommend Unrepeatable more. And I'm definitely going to be reaching out to Luke to have a conversation with him. And maybe Joshua Miller too. I don't know that guy, but they're both, I'm sure that I'm Steubenville connected, even though I went to TAC. I'm sure they're both accessible in some way. I'm friends with Luke on Facebook, so might be able to make that. That shouldn't be too hard. He seems like a really cool guy too. So I've only read like the first chapter, so I'm not going to really kind of go into that, but already it's sparking some ideas because I've just been camped out and building a story brand. So this power of narrative, this concept of story, this concept of a pattern of meaning that unfolds across stuff, and the pattern that we represent to ourselves, that we say things to ourselves about what this means and this happened, the sequence of causality, or the patterns of causality within something that unfolds over time, right? I've been pretty fascinated by that for a while. In fact, I'll do a pitch. The most recent, it's been forever since we did an Over the Counter podcast, me and Mark Gieschek. But if you go, if you search Over the Counter podcast, number 44, I think it is. It's the latest one out there. It's called Narrativity. I think that's the best podcast he and I have ever done. That is a really good show. Like, I listened to it not too long ago and I was like, we should do this show because I want to subscribe to this show. And, Mark and I have been talking about firing up Over the Counter as a distance podcast using ringer.com. We just are both so busy trying to get our schedules aligned where we can both be in front of a computer with a decent landline and do it. It's just been a little hard, but I have to check a bag because I'm going to have a suit and stuff with me. And when you're staying for 4 days and you're a big guy and you have a suit, just like, you can't do a carry on. So maybe I'll drag my recording equipment with me to Denver and maybe we'll knock out an over the counter while I'm there. That'd be kind of fun. So I've been looking at everything through the lens of story this last week, right? And kind of like how we build a take on something that this is this and this happened this way, right? So for instance, right? I went off a couple episodes ago about separating children from families. And okay, so let me sidebar political rant for a second here. In the same week, Mark, get out of my head. Mark just texted me while I'm on the, I was just sitting here talking to him, talking about him, and he texted me and said that he's coming back from Calcutta. I guess he's been with Mother Teresa's order again, teaching them. So in the same week, everyone is flipping out about how terrible it is. And I'm not saying it's not. It is. It's disgusting that they're to separate little small children, little small babies from their mothers and their families. And then Kennedy announces that he's retiring. And the same group that went absolutely ape crap over this just had a fit about this family separation thing are freaking out that Trump's going to put a Supreme Court judge in that might take away their right to kill babies and separate it, for a mother to separate herself from her child by killing the child. And then on the other hand, it's like, you know, I have all kinds of Trump supporter friends that are, you know, we're going on and on about the family thing. They're like, well, Obama did this and Obama did that. And it's like, I got to thinking about this. Could you imagine, just imagine with me, let's do a thought experiment. Trump returns to his old position from a few years ago and becomes pro-choice again. And he starts doing all kinds of very, very pro-abortion stuff. Could you possibly see a bunch of right-wingers saying, well, Obama did the same thing? It's like, no, that's the third rail. You can't mess with that one. But when he does something absolutely disgusting that's equally anti-life, equally anti-family, anti-dignity of the human person, people are like, well, Obama did the same thing. Right. Right. So I remember when you were like all but telling me that Obama was the Antichrist, right? So you're going to defend your dude by saying he acts like the guy that you thought was the Antichrist. Really? But then here's what's funny though. So I'm saying all that to say that I'm not being that guy, but I'm listening to NPR in the parking lot at the gym the other day. And, they're talking about ICE and about people calling for the abolition of ICE. And, like, you know, and hey, this thing came into existence not too long ago, you know? So they're like, hey, we want to find out why was this thing created? What does it do? Who did what they do before them? And kind of like, what's been the history of it, you know? So they brought on the former director of ICE. And so there's this, reporter talking to him, and God bless him, much to my surprise and chagrin, there's one honest journalist left in the world, and she strangely works at NPR evidently. Cause she didn't even ask the question. She'd done her research and she said, so, when it comes to detaining people at the border and immigration enforcement, the first Obama term was like way, way more aggressive than anything Trump's done in the last year. Right. And I was thinking, did I hear that right? And the ICE, former ICE director is like, oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and then they start talking about why they do that. Well, you know, they were trying to get comprehensive immigration reform at that time. And, you know, I guess Obama didn't want to be seen as being soft on immigration. And so he kind of stepped up enforcement. But let's just bask in this for a second. An NPR reporter asked the former director of ICE, and they both agreed on the fact, as a matter of record, that pick any, and this is what he said, literally, pick any year out of the first 4 years of the Obama administration. And any of those years is dramatically more aggressive on immigration and enforcement of immigration issues than the last year underneath Donald Trump. Now, I am not a Trump supporter. I was virulently anti never, 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 never Trump during the election. But think about that and ask yourself what you're being told wherever you get your news. Just put that in perspective. Any pick first year, second year, third year, fourth, any year out of the first 4 years that Obama was president, any of those years, compare it to the first year under Trump, Obama was roughly four times more aggressive on enforcing immigration than he has been. Have you heard anyone say that anywhere? See, we get these narratives, and that's where I want to get back to, right? We get these narratives where this happened because of this. I was thinking about this yesterday with 4th of July. Okay, 4th of July, happy 4th of July, happy, happy Independence Day, everybody. You know, there's all these competing narratives, right? So there is the, you know, there's the kind of the patriotic kind of like, you know, we came over here and we just wanted to be free and England wouldn't let us be free. So, you know, we kicked their ass and we had ourselves a Revolutionary War. We kicked their ass and, you know, and it was just like the Patriot with Mel Gibson, like it was all Bravehearty and we, cause the English were all super evil and we were like the good guys and we took over in America. Woo. You know, there's that side. Then there's like, yeah, you were colonists. You were part of this great sweeping move of colonialism. And you came over here and you completely decimated a civilization of indigenous people. And then couldn't even keep, you know. So then I'm like, okay, well, then you should still be. England was the one that had that idea, the whole empire thing, right? So the fact that we threw off their shackles after coming over here, doesn't that make it good? Well, no, because then you went and killed all the Indians. Okay. It's like there's like everyone kind of has this different narrative on kind of a major sweep of history, you know. And kind of a sidebar on that, I was thinking about this morning at the gym. Okay, yeah. We, as England, took over land where we had superior numbers and superior technology and battle and skill and method and all that. And we used our advantage in numbers and technology to overthrow people and take land that we wanted. We did. It was disgusting. It was a horrible thing to do. And it's what every single civilization has done from the smallest tribes to Alexander the Great, to Genghis Khan, all these people. Every major civilization in the history of the world, every small tribe with a neighboring tribe, if they had an advantage of tech and method and numbers, they used it to get more land and get more resources and to spread their kind of people out. So it was bad. We shouldn't have done that. But I kind of get sick of hearing like America is like this one horrible, terrible set of people that did this one thing. I'm like, dude, that is what, if there were 6 cave people over here and 4 cave people over here, and they figured out how to tie a stone on the end of a stick, these 6 people took this other cave away from these people. It's been happening since then. That is just the nature of mankind over the course of history. Is it good? No, it's fallen. It's bad, but that doesn't make America like some outlier different than everybody else. It means that we are really human and really fallen. Oh, but we had manifest destiny and all that, right? From the dawn of time, anyone who wanted someone else's land and had advantage of tech and method and numbers and took that, they have used their religion to give them a narrative to justify that in their mind. The great god Zumama has given them into our hands, or the crow of war has led us to victory in battle over these people, or manifest destiny, or what. It is by nature people who have something and want more to use that advantage to take more and then to justify it with the things and kind of their search for what's bigger than man. It just happens. I'm not justifying it. I'm saying that America is not but America's not this evil outlier that we all need to be ashamed of. They just did what everyone else did. I mean, speaking of the same thing, look at slavery, right? Slavery. We straight up bought human beings, an entire half of our country, you know, and before that it was common, right? But then we had a civil war over this, right? Every major civilization in the history of the world that still exists in the world had slavery. What's unique about America is that it stopped here. We were the first major civilization to go, no, you know what? This isn't cool. There was a lot of civilizations that had a chance to have a moment of national kind of examination of conscience and look at our actions and in light of our higher principles and go, no, you know, this isn't cool. We're not going to do this. And they didn't do it, but we did. It stopped here. We stopped it. We had literally a war where oceans of blood was spilled to try to stop this. I think that's what makes us different. Not that we rise above and we don't fall into this pattern of action and justification that every civilization has always fallen under, whether it was the slavery or whether it was the Indians. You know, we do the same things that people have always done. This Greek city-state would go over and try to take over this Greek city-state, and then they would all band together because the Persians were coming. They'd all get together and the Persians wanted their land, and they would push Persia off, and then they would go back to fighting amongst themselves. And, you know, look at, you know, Israel being traded by the Greeks and then the Romans. And, you know, it's like, or Poland, look at Poland just getting taken back and forth. People jockey for position in natural resources, and they use an advantage to get it. So that just is what it is, you know. But we kind of have figured out, hey, that's not a good thing. Now, we still fall into it sometimes in the name of self-defense and stuff like that. But I guess that's my 4th of July rant, is that I'm neither like the flag waving, like America's the greatest nation, we're different than all of them. No, we're actually not really that different. I think in our Constitution and in our Declaration, we are holding up an ideal that we're living up to slowly over time. I think we're kind of regressing from that in a lot of ways now. But I think on paper, America was the single highest expression of a way that you could philosophically, politically put together a group of people and require them to assent and to be responsible and to care and to align themselves with the common good. I think it was a very human, very beautiful attempt, this American experiment. But, and I know that I've had deep arguments with friends of mine that are still kind of like monarchists and think that liberalism in itself is the problem, or non-monarchists that think that liberalism is the problem in itself. Those arguments aside, I think that if you're going to have a form of a republic or something, I think that our founding documents represent, you know, from the politics of Aristotle and, you know, Plato's talk about, you know, democracy devolving into tyranny and all that, all the things that we've tried since then. The medieval period with serfs and landowners and all the stuff and the different forms of monarchy and the different things that have happened. And, you know, and then you have the French Revolution, laissez-faire and all that. You know, there's a thing that's interesting is, like, you know, we have with the French, we have kind of a freedom. And that's the problem. Well, this is the problem that people have with liberalism in particular, but they have freedom from religion. Like, they threw off the shackles of the divine right of kings, freedom from religion. And we kind of took one step forward and we said freedom of religion, right? We have a freedom of religion in our country. Now, what's interesting is, like, you know, you have the Polish Republic that kind of came out of when they emerged and threw off communism. That was a movement led by the church. Solidarity, the movement called Solidarity that had Lech Walesa at the beginning of that word, was the same word from Catholic social doctrine. They were a Catholic movement. They would have meet for mass every morning and stuff. That was a Catholic movement. That was freedom through religion. So we have freedom from religion, freedom of religion, and a republic, it's freedom through religion. And we have, and it, we, yeah, this is a whole other show though, to come back, talk about what is freedom Is it liberty? Is it license? The key comes down to, is it freedom from or freedom for? And there are friends of mine in my world that think that liberalism, classical Western liberalism even, is inherently freedom from. And you're unshackled, but you're kind of unhinged and unbounded too. And that's a whole nother, I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail. That's a rabbit trail I could do a whole show on. So happy 4th of July. We're just like everybody else, but in some ways we kind of did a little better than that, but we keep slipping back into being just like everybody else. But the good news is so does everybody else. Woo, America. No, I mean, I love my country. I'm not unpatriotic in any way. I think you're supposed to love your country. I think you're supposed to be patriotic. But it's funny. This year I just witnessed a lot of just unreflective flag waving, just like rah, rah, the 4th of July. That's kind of what that's for, you know? And then this knee jerk backlash protest, you know, kind of this, you know, it's kind of the we're better than everybody else. We're the greatest country to ever live. We're completely different. And we're the worst thing that's ever happened. We need to just completely change and become Sweden or something. I don't know. That was quite an aside. Let's go back to talking about story and narrative. But I mean, that is true. I mean, there's the story. I mean, which story is it? Evil white people in England did colonialism. We're part of colonialism. And instead of staying attached to England so that they could pull us out and give control back, we kind of broke off. And became our own colonialists, and, you know, and we're bad. And now we just need to do our mea culpas and take our medicine and open up the borders because, you know, hey, there's another, okay. Last political rabbit trail. So I was having an argument with a friend of mine about this, and, she said, look, that's just not what asylum, you know, being in danger from like gangs or other people in the civilization that you live in just is not what asylum was built for. And if everyone in the world who had a really bad situation came to America, then we would be overrun. And I got to thinking about, and I was arguing the other side, but I got to thinking about this at the gym this morning. I have really creative thought when I'm like just sitting in the sauna trying to loosen up because I'm stiff and I have all this pain and from skateboarding for 14 years before I got old and fat. I have these thoughts. And one of them was, hey, yeah, you guys want open borders? You want to see what it looks like if you just let a bunch of people in because they think that living in your nation would be better than where they came from because they were being oppressed back in their nation? Yeah, well, look at America. We were the guys that came in and took over, right? We were the ones that immigrated. We came over because we were trying to get away from England. And we came over here. And what happened? Oh, yeah, we killed everybody. We took over and we supplanted their culture. And it's exactly what people are worried about, right? So it can happen. We did it, but I don't think that's actually the case. But this is the 4th of July. Yeah, we're awesome, but we're kind of like everybody else. I don't know where this is going today. Okay, let's get back to that. Was all on a side. Okay, rewind back to where I was talking about story and narrative before I started saying a bunch of stuff that's going to offend everybody about Native Americans and slavery. No, like it's disgusting. And I could go on another rant right now about the reservation system and how that just absolutely was the wrong way to try to make things right. Well, they weren't trying to make things right. They were trying to get the problem out of the way. And that's just, I have friends that are reservation priests and other friends who have worked on a reservation, and that just does not work. That is a system that we need to figure out right there. All right. So story and narrative. The thought that I had this week that I want to just kind of talk a little bit about We're kicking in. We have 15 minutes left. If I'm going to do an hour, that's just, it's kind of the structure of the old show was chatty first 15 minutes, political rant. Third segment was always kind of, you know, more principles and philosophy underneath what I was ranting about. And then it would go spiritual in the fourth segment. So I've kind of followed my own path, my old pattern here today. I got to thinking about how to say it, just how we all represent a story. And every one of us is called, including in every group of us, a larger or smaller, even the state, but every one of us has a story that's being written, and it's being written with us, with our own free will and our cooperation with it, or our fighting the script or whatever. And that story ends. If you're sucking air right now, I don't care if you have cancer and you've got 2 weeks to live, or if you're 10, right? If you're sucking air right now, there is a story that you're in, and the final chapter or the final 10 chapters end with you being a saint. Because a saint is someone that is functioning as designed. God, I've talked about this a million times. I think you see the process really beautifully in the second chapter of Seeds of Contemplation by Thomas Merton. Being in its identity, I think it's called. Beings in their identity, or being in its identity, is the name of the chapters. And he talks about ideas in the mind of God. And we know from Revelation that we wouldn't know this any other way, right? But when God begins to speak, a concept forms, right? There's a concept, and obviously this all happens at once in God, but there's a concept that can be unspoken, and there can be a spoken concept. We know that because that's what the word is. This is what St. Thomas talks about, that the word is the concept. I hate to use the Kantian phrase, but you know, it's the image. It's the mental, internal reflection of himself, and it takes on its own personhood in God, and that's the word, right? And so when God got ready to, I mean, you happened in time. So when God decides to make a you, before he speaks you into existence, there's an idea of you, you know. God tells Jeremiah that before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. So he knows us before we are. He knows what we are. He has designed us. God's being is infinite. And so he communicates these tiny little aspects of his being by making people and things that can communicate, that are in the saints. That's why the more they become like Christ, the more they become partakers of divine nature, the more different and weird they get, because they become more themselves, right? I mean, the hippies were kind of on to something. The goal is to find yourself, right? Because when you find yourself, if you really found yourself, you'd find God, not because you're God, but because God made you in a way that he's trying to communicate some aspect of his being. And the you, the way you functioning as designed, are a saint, regardless of where you're at, regardless of what you did last night. You in your essence, what you're called to, the way you're designed, is sainthood. It's to function as designed, to be a reflection of the invisible God, to be a partaker of the divine nature. So there is a plan. There is a story, no matter where you're at, between now and dying, where there is a path forward, a story that ends with you being a saint. Now, what got me, and I've talked about that before, but then through reading Story Brand, Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller, I saw that he talks about the seven major aspects of any story, you know. And he's talking to, you see this character arc and all in some version, almost every classic story from Homer and the Bible all the way through the latest blockbuster, right? There's something inherently kind of embedded in the nature of story, in mankind's craving for meaning. And that is that there's a character who desperately wants something, who can't get it, and tries and tries, and the longing and that thirst grows and grows and grows. And when they're at the peak of their despair, a guide enters. And that guide gives them a plan and helps them go through that, calls them to action. And then in the end, they achieve that. And they, and that's kind of the hero's journey, right? This is Joseph Campbell and stuff too, right? This is this archetype. This is just the hero's journey. It's the, and we all wake up, and this is the insight that Donald Miller has on brands and stuff, is we all wake up the protagonist of our own story, right? We all wake up. We're all the hero, not because we're self-centered, because we see through the lens, we're the one living our story, right? So, but here's the thing, is that being aware of kind of two things I want to talk about. Being aware of where you are in your story, so to speak, looking at yourself through that. And notice that the key turning point in the hero's journey, in any protagonist's story, is being aware of his desire, trying to follow that desire, being frustrated in that desire, and that frustration pouring gasoline on the fire of his desire. Right? That is the key. That's what causes, it's that desire and that frustration of that repeated attempts and that absolute desperation that in narratively speaking draws the guide into his life to give him the answers and the plan and then call him to action. Right. So going back to, I've talked about this 100 times on the show, but Julian Caron in the book, Disarming Beauty, in that first chapter, he talks about, how, you know, we see these people that don't have, they're wrong, right? They have all these partial answers and wrong answers. And we think, oh, wow, they need some apologetics and we need to do some catechesis. We need to get them straightened out. They need information. And Caron says that, no, reality gives itself. Reality is designed to give itself. Reality gives itself when it's probed correctly, when it's questioned correctly. These people have partial answers and incomplete answers and insufficient answers because they're asking incomplete questions. They're not asking the real deep questions. And why are they not doing that? Because their desire has not been awakened. They've either dialed down their desire to match what they know exists or whatever. You know, they don't long for reality in a way that we're designed to as human beings, right? What Jazani would call the religious sense. That we don't long in that way anymore. So if you're not experiencing intense desire that's even being just continually frustrated, you need to have your desire awakened. And Caron says the same thing that Plato said about the good. He says that the only way to have your desire awakened is to get around some people whose desire has been awakened and spend time around them. And so what does that have to do with You know, I think a lot about evangelization, about discipleship, about the new evangelization and the type of work I do with Calyx, you know. And these two ideas came together in my mind, and I thought, look, I'm a story crossing a story, another story. Persons are stories. Persons are a point in the present that has a movement, a narrative movement in the past towards that moment, and has a script written from this moment till their death that ends with them being a saint, or they would still be sucking air. God has a plan, has an action, has a story written for that person. I don't care who they are. Donald Trump, some serial killer, the guy that's a good priest already. It doesn't matter who you are. There's a narrative between this moment and the moment of your death where you are a saint, that you are functioning as designed. Now, I mean, obviously, if you have a very small amount of time left, you might not be able, it would take a miraculous movement to bring the full fruit of the changes to your character and your intellect and even your body that would, you know, I mean, you might die a fat ADD saint that's still experiencing the feelings of addiction, which is probably who I am. But you can at least be, you know, I remember hearing, Dr. Barry Sears, that wrote that book, The Zone, talking about, you know, that all this lack of health is this, I think it's like an eicosanoid imbalance and the resulting inflammation. So you can fix that. And he's like, now you're a healthy person inside, your inflammation is now gone. This and this and this is functioning properly. You're just a healthy person trapped inside of a sick person at this person. And you have to now burn off all this fat and kind of like let your organs and all this stuff heal from that. But you fixed the problem inside, you know, but you so you might end up being a saint inside of a giant sinner or something, but there is definitely a story. If you've got any amount of time left, there is a moment where you could change and you could think differently. You could move differently. You could act differently and you could die a saint. Right. So that's all of us, right? We are stories. So evangelization or discipleship is a story interacting with another story. Now, what's interesting though, is that most of the people who are trying to do evangelization or discipleship or something are, how to say it, they are, they're needing to put themselves, they're needing to even brand themselves into the mode of, in the person of the guide, right? They're not trying to be Luke Skywalker. They're trying to find a Luke Skywalker who is completely frustrated by the death of his parents, who wants to get back at the Empire, and they need to be Obi-Wan Kenobi or Yoda. They need to come along and give him the information and the plan and the training so that he can then be called into action to go blow up the Death Star, right? And but there's this mismatch because most of the people that are actually moving themselves into the situation of being the guide haven't gotten to a point of frustration and desire enough to where they've brought a guide into their life. And even if they have, they go find little Luke Skywalker who isn't even aware of the pain of his parents dying. He's kind of numbed it down or whatever. And then they start trying to train him when he's like, I don't care. I don't want to get back at the Empire. I don't know. You guys are all obsessed with getting back at the Empire. I'm not interested. So the best thing you could do would be to like go, dude, they killed your parents. You would have to add to his frustration somehow. You have to awaken his desire for something, you know? And so that has giant ramifications. If you think about the way we build our ministries, the way we build outreach, we build these things to just look, here's a tap of training and information, and we're just going to turn it on. And anybody who comes around, we're just going to squirt them with this information gun. They're just, so I'm going to turn the information hose on them. And we're going to give them a plan, then call them to action. Well, maybe they're not at that place in their story. And so one thing this book is starting to talk about, and I think that this is going to become, this is all, I've always talked about this. It's a little clearer now, but one thing I want to push in Calyx is the ability to hear someone over time, to listen, to learn their story, to kind of see them as a story and hear who they are by the path they've been on, you know, try to figure out by really coming to know. And you have to be in relationship in community to do that. That's what I think everybody gets wrong. They think that you can do that by bumping into someone on the corner because you put up a sign, you know, says Jesus is real, change my mind. Or, you know, okay, great. And then people come over and argue with you or something. Somehow we can do these rhetorical tricks or these apologetic methods, and we can get to know these people by finding out what their positions on things are. We think that people, I guess that's what it boils down to, is that the entire Catholic world is either immune to and doesn't care about evangelization and discipleship, or they think that people are default placeholders for positions on ideas or things, and they just need to be refuted and then taught. Where really they're stories that need to be listened to. And it's funny. Let's see, where have we seen this before? Oh yeah, Jesus. The only time you see him just like being a total jerk and quoting scripture straight at people is to the Pharisees and to the devil. Every single time Christ meets a good solid pagan of any kind, or someone who's actually seeking, who's actually broken, who's actually a mess in need of healing, what does he do? Almost every time he asks them questions and he tells them stories. That's what he does every single time. So I think we just have to have some patience in that. So there you go. That's the show this week. Our nation is just like all the other ones, but it kind of isn't. And you're a story. Be a story. Treat other people as if they're stories. That's the moral of the story today. All right. Well, there you go. Episode 6. Thanks for coming out, kids. Do I have shout outs? That I haven't done? Probably. I already shouted out John McClain for being so disappointed in my not doing a show last week. Shout out to Sophia and Carl Bunderson for not getting the initial tag in my Facebook post about going back to Denver. I feel bad. I mean, little Maria needs to see her favorite person in the world, and her favorite person in the world is definitely not Sarah Stacy. God, such an inside joke. All right. If I promise you a shout out and you didn't get it, it's been a minute. So right back me on the Facebook page. All right, kids. Thanks for coming out, and we'll see you next week. Let's pull the plug off the cork on another episode of Almost Did It, The Whaley Show. Thanks for coming out.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.